Don't you want the story twice? Have no fear, the studio say remake so.
How do we start? Every time.
Excitement for the podcast.
Wow.
We're having fun.
So much fun. We watched some great movies this week, I think. Welcome to episode 8, of Once More with Feeling, which is a podcast about great original movies and their often not so great remakes. I'm Gus Schiff. Oh, I'm a screenwriter and like sometimes director, comedian, improviser, various other things.
We've switched in our our introduction approaches. Now you're the deeply uncomfortable one.
Yeah, I just get really squirmy.
And
right away.
I'm perfectly satisfied saying that I am a film critic and scholar of media.
What's your name?
Movies. Well, my name's Mariana. Nice to meet you.
Okay, we've met. This week we watched 101 Dalmatians.
It was so good.
101. It was so good. And we also watched 101 Dalmatians. And we also watched Cruella, but that's just for Patreon.
Yeah. So if you want to hear that, our hot takes about Cruella,
give us
a little money. Just a little.
Just a little money. For the price of one cup of coffee,
you
too can support.
Much less than a price of a cup of coffee these days, please. Have you seen how we're tariffing Brazil?
A cup of drip coffee from like a mediocre diner in
from like Illinois. The gas station.
Yeah, for the price of a gas station cup of coffee plus maybe the price of like an on sale normal size candy bar.
Yeah.
You can support us.
What else is $2?
Oh god. I don't know.
Is anything $2?
One piece of chapstick.
I think those only come like in like two
three quarters
packages.
Of a square foot per month. Anyway, so 101 Dalmatians, the original one, came out in 1961. Do you know what was going on in 1961? It's not that dissimilar from. What's been going on since like Alice in Wonderland?
Is it wars?
It's
or wars
the Cold
happening?
War. Okay. It's the Cold War is happening,
and it's many
it's a lot of,
proxy conflicts.
Yeah, specifically what happened in 1961 that's Cold War related. Well, first of all, this is the year that JFK becomes president. He was elected, obviously, in 1960, sworn into office. I think it had changed to January 20th by this point. Right after Dwight Eisenhower's very famous, you know, watch out for the military-industrial complex farewell address, which, you know, my personal opinion, we really fucked that one up. Did not
really
do a great
dropped
job.
The ball on that one, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Ike. That's our bad. So what happens Cold War-wise? There's like a civil war situation in the Congo and U.S. With U.N. peacekeepers inside. The U.S. very publicly warns the USSR to stay out of it. JFK establishes the Peace Corps for a bit of soft power. Yuri Gagarin goes to space. Wow, first ever man in space. What else happens? The fucking Bay of Pigs happens. The Berlin Crisis happens, which is the reason the wall went up. JFK, it's like halfway through the year, like 3 months into his presidency, publicly encourages people to build fallout shelters like in their backyard. Which I always thought, like, you know, whenever I'm like playing Fallout or whenever I'm watching a movie from the 60s or the 50s, like the backyard fallout shelters, I thought those were jokes.
Yeah.
They might still be jokes, but it's based on official advice from the president.
I think in Fallout, the joke is, I think it's called the Kaminsky shelter, nuclear protection on a budget. And every single Kaminsky shelter you find, you can open it and they're all full of skeletons. Because that shit doesn't work. You're not gonna be able to like avoid a nuclear. I mean, you might survive a nuclear bomb, you know, if it gets dropped a few miles from your head. Yeah, you like sit around in a... in what is essentially a glorified tornado shelter, but yeah. Enjoy your cancer.
The best way to not get killed by a nuke?
Gosh,
this is
like,
not a trick question.
Don't live in large military target cities? I don't know.
Yeah, sort of. It's like, don't have nukes in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way also.
Nuclear disarmament. Hot take.
Yeah.
What else? There's more. Everybody does nuclear testing. There's the Soviets kind of vaguely threatened to invade Finland. And the U.S. sends very heavy quotation marks military advisors to South Vietnam. So, yeah, a lot of Cold War stuff.
That's going
to
go great for the next 12 or 13 years.
A very auspicious year. And what else is going on? Racism's going on. Yay! The Freedom Riders start riding buses in to the South to protest the thing that happened. That's not it. It's the Supreme Court recently desegregates bus rides, and the Freedom Riders ride buses into the South to be like, fuck you, the South. Integration. So of course the KKK at one point in Alabama, I think, attacks a bus of Freedom Riders. They burn the bus, they beat the riders. What else is going on in American culture? Catch-22 comes out. The book that originated the term Catch-22, fun fact. Breakfast at Tiffany's comes out, which I don't think I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I might have. I don't know. I know the song.
I feel like you'd remember if you did.
Ken Doll comes out, like Barbie's Ken. That's only 2 years after Barbie, so that's cool. And then Six Flags theme park opens for the first time in Texas. So that's 1961 in about 4 minutes, minus a fallout aside.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Disney's doing very well as a company. Their last animated movie, which was Sleeping Beauty in 1959, which we covered, but only for our Patreon people, because there was not a modern remake, sort of. It didn't do well. It did very poorly, and it made Walt lose interest in animation because his whole company was doing quite well. The parks, the movie distribution, the live action stuff, except animation. So there was some serious consideration around this time of shuttering the whole division, fun fact. But sentimentality saved it. So let me tell you a little bit about this movie.
Okay.
It's got a real short synopsis. This time, two Dalmatians, Pongo and Purdy, they fall in love and they convince their humans to marry each other. Soon enough, they have 15 adorable little Dalmatian puppies, which are stolen by the fur-obsessed monster Cruella de Vil, who plans to turn them and 48 other stolen puppies into fur coats.
84.
Oh my god. 84. What did I say? 64?
You said 48.
48? I don't have dyslexia, but, I could. They locate the puppies through the Twilight Bark, which is basically dog telegraphs. And they're, at Hell Hall, old Cruella Manor, deep in the London countryside. Pongo and Purdy run away to rescue their pups with the help of, several other dogs and animals who are really cute, and that's the movie.
What happens to Cruella at the end? I forget.
She drives off the cliff.
Oh yeah, and then they're in the river, but does anything happen after that?
Yeah, I don't think
so.
Is
it just that final humiliation?
I think it's just that one.
Okay.
But I'm not sure.
That's fine.
Let me tell you a bit about 101 Dalmatians, the history of it, and how it got made, and all that other stuff that I normally do during this part of the podcast. So 101 Dalmatians is a children's book that was released in 1956, so 5 years earlier, 5 years before the movie, by English novelist Dodie Smith. It was first serialized in the women's magazine Woman's Day. as the Great Dog Robbery, but then renamed to the much better 101 Dalmatians, once published as a book. And yes, there is a sequel, and it is called The Starlight Barking. What a great name.
It is a great name.
It is about an alien lord of the Dog Star offering all dogs on Earth complete immortality.
It's trippy.
Very different from the first book. The plot of the movie is very similar to the plot of the book. The biggest differences are that the humans are already married, and they're named Mr. and Mrs. Dearly, instead of, like, Roger something. I don't remember. They're not named Dearly in the animated
movie. In Cruella, they're named Darling.
In the live action, they're named Darling. The only time they're not named, I think so. The only time they're not named Darling.
I think they're Dearly in the live action.
Dearly. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I confused those words, too. Maybe I am dyslexic. Pongo's wife in the book.
I don't think they have the last names in the animated version. Anyway, this doesn't matter. Keep
whatever.
Going.
Who cares? Pongo's wife in the book is named Mrs. Perdita's basically like a wet nurse, a doggy wet nurse. There's some classic like European anti-Romani elements. And Cruella has a cat who hates her and a husband. That's kind of the only big differences. Disney learns about the book in 1957, and he buys the film rights for about $25,000. Walt himself wasn't super involved, like, in the production of this one, not nearly as much as he used to be. And the reason is, as I said earlier, he just kind of lost interest in animation. And if you want to learn more about why, you can listen to our Patreon-exclusive episode about Sleeping Beauty. Now, every other Disney movie that we've watched, and all the ones that we also haven't watched this far, they all had, like, a team of people doing the story. This was the first movie that it was all done by one guy, a guy named Bill Peet, who'd been around, like, since Snow White, and he just got to write it on his own, which I think is really cool.
Why is that?
Yeah. I don't know. I think he... I don't know. Maybe he wanted to. Maybe they just didn't, like... Because they didn't really move the way that far from the original material, they didn't need another writer. I'm not sure. Now, this movie is not a musical, which is devastating to me. The music in it, which is, I think, just the Cruella de Vil song and the Canine Crunchies jingle, are both diegetic. Which is a word I'm using properly this time. but there were, like, other songs written for the movie, so I think at some point it was going to be a musical. Like, Horace and Jasper, the two criminals who dognapped the puppies, they had a song called Don't Buy a Parrot from a Sailor. The Dalmatian puppies had two songs. One is Cheerio, Goodbye, Toodaloo, Pip, Pip, Hip, Hip. When they're, like, running away. And then the other one that they had is the March of the 101, which is when they're, like, on the van at the end that is driving them back to London. You can find them on YouTube. They're, like, not good. Okay. They're not that good. Like, the Cruella de Vil song is the best song. So, like...
It's a banger. It's so much fun.
It's so good. Like, I understand why that one song made Roger a gazillionaire. So I don't know if you noticed this part, but I loved the style of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was very stylized. Like, I think Sleeping Beauty was also stylized in a different way, but this one was, like, modern and abstract. Ish.
Yeah, all the backgrounds.
Very, like, this was, like, I think a lot of the other Disney movies we watched, it's kind of a toss-up as to, like, when they were made. And I think this one really reflects, like, the art movement of, like, the early 60s, late 50s.
With
that color palette and stuff.
Uh-huh.
One of the reasons that was true is because they introduced a new kind of animation technology technique that used Xerox machines to basically eliminate the need to manually ink each frame. But as a result, like, some of the sketch lines would be left over. So you notice, like, on a lot of the puppies, on a lot of the people, you still kind of see those pencil sketches sometimes.
I love that. I think it's really charming.
I loved it so much. Like, this one, it feels a little scrappier, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, like...
But all the, like, all the character animation is really good. Like, it's all very detailed. All the things that need to be detailed are... And it, you know, it's clear that they're, I don't know, I think it's interesting that it feels like they're cutting corners, but doing so in a way that still feels intentional, I guess, if that makes sense. Like,
it does make sense.
Yeah.
Art. And, you know, and it was still like a pretty expensive movie. It was like somewhere between $3.6 and $4 million. But this technique and the style that came out of it cut that cost. Like, if they hadn't done that, if they had still had to do, like, the old style of ink, it would have cost, like, at least $7 million, according to some estimates. So, it's cool. And I think it really speaks to the talent of the animators, because there were still, like, it's not like they just pulled in a group of, like, new, hip, beatnik 50s kids to animate it. It was, a lot of the leadership on this project was, like, the nine old men, the Disney's nine old men. We've heard of this.
I don't think we talked about the nine old men.
We have not talked about it, which was such a huge mistake. But
listen, basically, we're not Disney scholars. This is
basically this is just
generalized industry knowledge.
But just to go over that, this who the nine old men are, briefly. They're just like nine Disney vets who worked, I think, just at Disney from 1920s and 30s. So like pre-Snow White, right? Mm-hmm. All three, like all nine of them were at the company by the time Snow White came out, and they worked at Disney their whole careers, like even past Disney's death. Which is, I think, in like 5 years from when this, when 101 Dalmatians comes out. Just to name them, those nine old men are John Lounsbery, aka Fergie Ferguson. Don't know why he had changed his name, whatever. Les Clark, Wooly Reitherman, Milt Call, Eric Larson, Mark Davis, Ward Kimball, Frank Thomas, and Ollie Johnston. Why was I talking about them?
Why were you talking about them?
Oh, no. Oh, they were, like, a lot of them worked on 101 Dalmatians. So it's the same, okay. You know. So it just, I think it speaks to their talent and the talent of the people that Disney put in this creative decision-making areas, that they can embrace a new art style and, in our opinion, execute it so well. Sleeping Beauty, the one that came out 2 years prior, also extremely stylized in a very different way. And I think it was really cool how much they were experimenting around this time with, like, the look, while still retaining kind of that, like, classic Disney character style and yet still making things feel new and feel different. Walt Disney fucking hated how this movie looked.
Yeah, he's out of his mind. It's about time for him to die at this point. Oh, please.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, from what I could find, I mean, you know, you're not... I don't like wishing for people's deaths.
He's already dead.
Even when they're already dead. And unless they're like a Nazi. Walt was only a little anti-Semitic. No, I'm sorry. I confused him with Henry Ford. That's my bad. But he was like...
Wasn't Walt anti-Semitic too? This is a...
Was he? I don't know. Like, two of the nine old men are Jewish.
You know,
Walt,
the head of the SS Disney was gay. Like,
anti-Semitism. There's not a lot of, like, on the record anti-Semitism. The way that Ford Company handed out the articles of the principles of
Elders of Zion,
when you bought a car. Protocols of Zion, thank you. When you bought a car, like, Walt, you know, the Disney company was not like, here's your ticket to Snow White. Here's why all the Jews are bad. Please read it at your leisure.
Sure.
So Walt,
I'm just saying his company is like growing past his opinions, and it's time to put him out to pasture. He should have retired.
Yeah,
he's insane for not liking how this movie looks. That's basically
right. From what I could find, like, the people there were basically like, Walt was old. Like, he was really attached to that, to the pen and ink style, to the old Disney style, because it was his style. You know, in the new version, with the much more modern elements, the very, like, mid-20th century art style, way too big a departure for him. You know, and I think actually comparing it to Sleeping Beauty, which at the very least, listeners, go check out a still from, you can see, like, how it looks, especially in the background. That's kind of Walt's version of super stylized. And then 101 Dalmatians, only 2 years later, I think is the animator's version of what is super stylized. I really like both of them, but I think I like 101 Dalmatians a little more, which is crazy. Yeah, I think it's gorgeous. You think it's gorgeous. Most people think it's gorgeous. And everybody in America at the time thinks it's gorgeous. It came out January 25th in 1961, and it does crazy well. It makes over $6 million for Disney. They make over $6 million for their like box office share, distributor rental, however it worked back then. It's the first ever animated film to earn over $10 million in the box office on its during its initial run. As of 2018, it was the 10th best performing movie ever at the French box office, behind two other animated Disney movies. Have you read these notes already?
No, I haven't.
Do you want to guess what those other two movies are?
Well, I'm looking at them now.
Fuck.
Were they okay, the Jungle Book at number 9 and Snow White at number I want to say 4?
Oh my god, you got it exactly right. It completely recovers the animation studio financially from the bomb that was Sleeping Beauty, and Disney himself doesn't really care. At this point in his life, he was all focused on Disneyland and live action.
Disney, and everybody loves the live action mid-century Disney.
Yeah, those classic films such as and we can't forget,
I think, like, Shaggy Dog maybe came out around.
Oh my god,
time.
Shaggy Dog did come out in 1961.
Oh, we need to do a Shaggy Dog episode, I think. Did
no,
we
don't,
talk about this?
It's not animated. It's not animated.
Doesn't
sorry,
matter. It's a Disney remake.
No, we're doing live action. We're doing animated Disney to live action Disney.
When was that decided? I thought it was this
at the beginning.
No, this is just a remake podcast.
The podcast is this season is animated Disney to live action Disney.
I mean, whatever.
Just don't make me watch a live action Tim Allen movie. That's such a mean thing to do.
It's supposed to be one of the worst movies ever.
Oh god. Anyway, critics also loved this film. I know what everybody's thinking. What did podcast favorite critic Bosley Crowther at the New York Times say? He didn't say anything. What? No. This movie was covered by Howard Thompson. Oh, what a dick. Who loved it, but felt it was somewhat, he called it stark. And he said he felt Cruella makes the Snow White witch seem like Pollyanna.
Is that a compliment? Must be. Maybe?
I don't know. He seems like, when I was reading it, he seems like legitimately concerned for children watching this. And he was like, Cruella is like so stark, so scary. He compared, literally, he's like, at some point in the review, he says, like, listen, if your kitty could watch Psycho, they should be able to survive Cruella.
Jesus Christ.
Which, like, I don't know what Howard Thompson looks like, but I feel like he's got those kind of, like, blocky trapezoidal glasses and, like, a straw, like, fedora. You know, and he always wears like a light gray suit.
And a bow tie.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely a bow tie. Light gray suit, and then every day a different pattern on his shirt. and a matching pattern on the bow tie.
That's super interesting. I think that's like, because like we've talked in previous episodes about Scary Disney and mm-hmm. what that says about the way that people were thinking about childhood and children's mm-hmm. ability to engage with adult themes mm-hmm. in times like the 30s or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I love Cruella. She's so iconic.
I adore her.
but she is like, she's a horrible human being. I understand, you know, I don't know about concern, but being like, oh my god, I like, oh, this is a movie about a lady who wants to skin puppies and turn them into coats.
Well, after they're dead, like, she's not flaying them.
I don't know how much the difference matters. But like, the idea that kids wouldn't be able to handle Cruella, that's new, you know. It's not like we've ever come across reviews of previous movies that were like, oh, I don't know if the kids will be able to handle Dumbo.
No, you know? that's actually not correct.
Oh.
I think I've mentioned a couple times, but one of the things that does come up a lot is like, you know, the kid might get a little spooked by scary part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But all around, like, and it's, I think as far back as Snow White, it was like, the forest scene is pretty spooky, and the witch is a little creepy. But the kids should get a good jolt out of it, maybe. But they, you know, watch out, mm-hmm. You know, because that's every like that's part of the classic Disney strategy, strategy is to throw a little bit of like kid appropriate horror into these movies. The guy, whoever wrote for Time magazine, fucking loves puns, made me upset when I was reading.
A bunch of the reviewers for the for the 1996 version were very punny as well, very proud of that. Movies are going to the dogs.
Yeah. They called 101 Dalmatians the wittiest, most charming, least pretentious cartoon feature Walt Disney has ever made.
Cute.
They really loved it. And then Dodie Smith herself, the author of the original book, adored this movie. So much so that in her sequel, Starlight Barking, Cruella has the hairstyle from the movie. Because I guess she just had, like, normal hair in the original book.
How nice.
Yeah, that's all my notes. What'd you think of the movie?
Oh, I love it. This movie kicks ass. I think this really is my favorite Disney movie we've rewatched so far. It's so good.
Yeah.
You liked Lady and the Tramp. Do you think this is
I really loved Lady and the Tramp. They're both so good, and like this one does cameo like a lot of Lady mm-hmm. and the Tramp dogs. Which I really liked. I just like it is just so good. Like that even just the opening scene where Pongo is like objectifying all these female dogs.
It's one of my favorite scenes.
It's a great scene. Like they're just like the way that the animators make the dogs and their pets look like so similar, but also like this one's obviously a dog and that one's obviously a human, and they don't do any kind of cheap mm-hmm. tricks.
But they move the same, which is so cute.
Yeah, it's just like it's just so well done. I wrote in my notes, like not that far into the movie, I wrote this whole movie is jazz.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's like not really clear where any of this is going or why we're doing this.
Yeah.
But it all comes together, and it's like it's kind of difficult to predict, you know, like, you mm-hmm. know, the puppies are going to make it home, but it really isn't clear how or who's going to save him.
Is the colonel going to make it home? The colonel is one of the dogs who helps the puppies.
Yeah, maybe my favorite
Sergeant
character.
Tibbs?
The colonel or Sergeant Tibbs, I think, are my favorites.
Incredible.
I love how the colonels, they like they're animating all these different dogs so well, like they're all so specific to themselves, and like the colonel as like they get across the idea that he's old so well, and like with his elderly dog bark and how like his entire body like shakes a little every time he barks. It's so cute. I love it so much.
He was great.
It's not racist, which is awesome.
I know. And thank God all the characters are white, so they can't be racist. There was a lot of smoking that I noticed. Like
there was
Roger,
a lot of smoking, yeah.
Smoking, Cruella smoking, my wonderful girlfriend. A lot of smoking in these kids' movies, she said. She's concerned about the kids. She used to be a teacher. The Horace and Jasper were so good. They were so, like, classic. There's that, like, classic vaudeville comedy duo.
Yeah, one is skinny, they, like, one is fat, one is tall, one is short.
Well, yeah,
one is smart, one is stupid.
Yeah, well, not that smart, but, like...
Hey, smarter.
Smarter, yeah.
One of them's
very
the smart
evident,
one.
Very Abbott Costello, and I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's great.
It's really pretty.
It's gorgeous. All it's the really snow pretty. Scenes... are so beautiful. All the humor, like it's
funny,
yeah,
but also clever. Like there was an either Ether joke.
Yeah, exactly.
Either Ether joke. Wonderful Girlfriend said to that one, they would never do a chemistry pun in modern Disney movies.
No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. And also, like, the physical humor they're animating is also just really great and clever and inventive. I love when like Nanny's trying to get through the door and she's like trying to pull on the doorknob and Jasper is holding it on the other end and then lets it go. Like that's great. Yeah. I love it. All the fat puppy antics. Totally. It's so cute.
Oh, yeah. Everything, every problem that they had running away from Cruella was because of the fat dog.
Yes.
And I was...
He's just too hungry. Like, well, Lucky also just loves... He loves the TV and can't pay any goddamn attention.
Yeah, that's okay. But except for that opening TV part, everything is the fat puppies' fault.
It's fine. They're puppies.
Yeah, you get little bullyings, okay? If they're young enough, they won't remember. I thought it was so good. Like, even like the... God damn it. I've got my pen. Even that opening before they get kidnapped, when the puppies are like... going to sleep because they're so tired.
Mm-hmm.
I just yawned thinking about it. But like it was so good that I caught the yawn.
Like and
not only
it again here in this
not
instance.
Only yeah. It was what's it called? They had a yawn flare up. Like not only did it work cross species, but it worked like 2D animation to real life.
Yeah,
that's how good that yawn was. I can't say enough good things about this movie. One of the all-time classic Disney villains.
Oh my god, she's incredible. We already texted a little bit about this, but it's an absolute crime that she's not in Kingdom Hearts. I don't understand how that happened.
They even have, like, in the first game, you have to collect the 99 puppies.
Yeah, all the puppies
and
are
I
lost.
And I missed 6 of them because I couldn't figure out how to get back to Monstro when it spit me out.
I never got the puppies. Every single time I played Kingdom Hearts, I go into it, like, resolving to find all the puppies. And then as soon as the quest is given to you or whatever, I'm like, I'm not going to do this.
You know they have guides.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you can go to, like,
pay attention to other shit.
Are you second screening Kingdom Hearts?
What? What do you mean?
Are you second screening Kingdom Hearts?
What do you mean am I second? What's that mean?
Like, are you fucking playing Kingdom Hearts while, like, a really good podcast about great original movies in there? Not so great remix. It's playing in the background.
I might be.
Okay.
What's it to you?
That's, Well, no, I'm just checking because you said you're focusing on other stuff. Whatever, it doesn't matter.
I'm focusing on the more important quests, like making sure worlds don't get destroyed.
Saving Kyrie from Ansem and Xenohort.
Yes, precisely. Thank you. See, you get it. I don't understand why you pretend not to.
I do. Well, I Cruella was so good, and one of the. I'm not sure exactly like the order of like sketch, voice, etc., so on. Mm-hmm. But there was a quote that I found in my research from one of the animators, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I know where it is, and I don't want to look for it. But he's basically saying like the reason I animated Cruella so well is because like whoever voiced her, I'm going to check. Cruella De Vil original voice. No, it is not Wendy Raquel Robinson from The Descendants.
It is not.
Betty Lou Gerson.
Yes.
Original voice, Betty Lou Gerson. Gave such an incredible performance. Like, gave all of that to work with. Mm-hmm. That he was just, like, constantly hit with incredible inspiration.
It's such a great voice, and it really is a great character design. Like, and that's part of what makes her so awesome and so iconic. I think that's another aspect of like canon Disney villainy that I don't think somebody like Lady Tremaine fits the bill with because she's too normal looking. You know?
Okay.
Cruella is it's such a I love what they're doing there, where she has this like massive silhouette with that fur coat, and that has all this movement to it. But then her actual body, like, is so lost in that coat, and when you see it, it's just like she's like stick skinny. It's so funny
with those
little pencil dress,
the cheekbones that she had. Mm-hmm. I always thought, like in my mind, Cruella De Vil's like 60.
Yeah,
but. She's an old school friend.
Yeah, she's Anita's like, age.
That's how.
This is what smoking will do to you, kids.
But Roger also looks like in his late 20s.
Right, yeah.
And he smokes.
That's true.
Don't smoke if you're a woman. Only smoke if you're a man. These are the lessons that Disney gives
Maybe it's the cigarette holder. Or maybe it's wealth.
That's what it is. So good. And I think that's very correct about like the silhouette being a super important part of Disney villainy. Mm-hmm. Because like, look, I love Aladdin.
Yeah.
If you put the silhouette of Aladdin alongside the silhouette of like a bunch of background characters in that movie, I don't think I could guess Aladdin.
Yeah.
But if you put Jafar against literally any other character, I'm like, that guy's Jafar.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Same with Ursula and Ariel. Mm-hmm. Same with Cruella and any other person in this movie. And I think, like, if we think of, like, the last couple of Disney movies that have come out, like, since the 50s, it was Peter Pan. This is not in order. Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, Lady and the Tramp, Sleeping Beauty, another one that I'm forgetting, Cinderella,
mm-hmm.
And then this one, 101 Dalmatians. And I think, like, this is really when they were kind of figuring out that silhouette. Because the evil stepmom from Snow White, she's got a silhouette with the crown.
Yeah.
She's got a silhouette as the crone. But she's still kind of like a person.
It's a little basic. But Captain Hook, incredible silhouette.
Captain Hook is a villain.
Uh-huh.
Maleficent is a villain.
Yeah.
Cruella is a villain.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I don't believe there's another, like, I think between now and the Disney Renaissance, at least for what we're looking, well, the movies that we're watching, because they were remade, it's Jungle Book and Pete's Dragon, and then we're at the Disney Renaissance.
Okay. Wow.
And so I think, I know. It's literally...
It's like 20 years.
It is... Over 20 years. Holy. 27 years. Yeah.
That's crazy.
But I think, and this will be something that I think we talk about a lot more, but every single one of those movies, except for maybe Winnie the Pooh, has just, like, a capital V villain mm-hmm. in it. all the Disney Renaissance movies do. And I think a big reason for that is that they looked to this era. They looked to kind of the Peter Pan
right
through 101 Dalmatians era and was like, this is the last time we were.
Right, what's working
I mean,
here?
I love the Jungle Book, but it's like, it's, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Jungle Book is great.
Jungle Book's great. But, you know, and it's just really cool how you can so clearly like look to, especially now when the industry mm-hmm. is so dog shit. Although, and to be fair, a lot of great movies came out this year.
But yeah, it was a nobody's really good them. Year for movies. That's what yeah. social unrest will do.
Yes. This is what I've been saying for years.
Yeah, civic collapse makes good art.
But, you know, the ability to look into your art form, to nearby art forms, to your industry, to related industries, and look 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago or more and see, like, what really worked mm-hmm. about what they were doing at that time and how do we bring it back?
Yeah.
How do we do our version of yeah. it? How do we modernize it?
It's another thing that recent Disney has so failed at, even when they do try to do original stuff, which is pretty yeah. baffling to me. Like, I like Dr. Facilier a lot, as a character and as a character design. Mm-hmm. but even there, like, he's no Hades, he's no Ursula, you know?
That's the guy from
Princess and the Frog.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's too much of a person.
He's too much of a person, exactly. And then
the only silhouette is the top hat. What
yeah, exactly.
The top hat?
Yeah, he's got like kind of a muffin top belly, which I think is really funny and cute. But that's not it. That's way too subtle, you know. The costume itself looks really good and the color palette and everything, but it's that silhouette. The silhouette is really, really necessary. Even Gaston, you know, Gaston looks like a mm-hmm. person, but extra, you know, if you put Gaston's silhouette, like he fits with all the other Disney villains.
I agree.
And then most recently with Wish, oh my God, what a fucking failure. It's such a horrible movie. Like that, I hope actually does get a remake someday. It's like, there's like kind of a weird little cottage industry on YouTube with, I don't know about cottage industry, but like, certainly a fervent fandom that has devoted itself to fixing Wish, like fixing its stupid songs and its like dog shit story, like editing it properly. And it could have been so good. And one of its,
I never saw Wish because it looked bad.
It's terrible.
Why is it so bad?
It feels unfinished in pretty much every direction. It feels like, and like part of the, one of the things that a lot of the fans, are sort of landing on is that they had this, in pre-production, they like that there's a bunch of concept art that exists that like points to Wish having been originally intended as a romance instead of like a sort of like quirky new Disney heroine type movie. Which is very classic Disney, you know, and then they and like the star was like a Peter Pan reference basically, and was like this embodied star boy who was silent and you know, it's like their relationship built over the movie, and then eventually they just scrapped that and turned the star into just a literal like plush shaped star that just is a magical thing, and it like that just sucks. It all sucks. They hired a pop music writer for the songs instead of a musical theater writer. That's like
you remember the Spider-Man musical?
Yes.
They hired U2 to write the music,
right?
And I was like, oh wow, I wonder what U2 writing a musical is like. It's not.
Yeah, it turns out
it's just
bad.
It's just YouTube. Yeah. It's just their music.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah. And one of the worst things about Wish is that its villain sucks. To our point here, he has a terrible silhouette. He just looks like a guy. Even worse, he looks like kind of a nice guy.
In Wish?
Yeah. It's bad. Yeah. It's bad, bad, bad. His villain song sucks too. It's a bad movie. Terrible. Really, really embarrassing,
I will say,
for
like,
Disney's centennial movie.
Yeah. I think Disney's been trying to move the silhouette to the hero
mm-hmm.
starting with, like, technically it's Pixar, but starting with Brave.
Right. I think it works in Brave.
Yeah, and I think it works in, like, Tangled, kind of, and it works in Frozen, sort of.
Yeah, Tangled is another one where the villain is, you know.
Fine. Yeah. The Frozen villain literally doesn't matter.
Yeah, right.
At all. But I think Elsa still gets that silhouette.
I wonder why this is the case, because, like...
Yeah.
I don't...
Have we uncovered a grand strategy?
I mean, I don't think Disney gains anything from this. What is gained by making the villain less interesting?
I think that Disney... Here's my honest thought. Yeah. I think Disney has been targeting women more as a primary audience.
Do you think they're...
I think...
Okay, yeah, continue.
And I think, like, making the... Because they've all been heroines, too, you know? Luca was a Pixar movie. By making the princess girl, like, the draw of the movie, the unique, interesting character, they get a lot more merchandising money from these, like... 8-year-olds who really want to dress up as Elsa for Halloween.
Sure, but like most Disney protagonists were girls anyway, you know?
Yeah, but I think they want a bigger, like a more girl draw. Like I don't know.
Do you think they're targeting? I mean, you said they're, well, I mean, because there's a difference between, like, girl is a different quadrant than women.
Yeah,
so,
I think girl.
Okay, you think they're targeting girls?
I think girl. Well, because, like...
I would argue that they're targeting women.
Okay, yeah, I could see women. I could definitely see women. I think Disney got too aware of Disney Adult.
Yeah, okay, that's kind of like, what I was...
Okay, cool.
Working toward.
Yeah, then you say it.
Gus, do you think they're targeting Disney adults?
I think they might be targeting... I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the company became too aware of Disney adult and was like, hold on, why would we focus on growing our audience among everyone when we could just squeeze these fucking idiots for everything that we're... Man. No offense if you're a Disney adult.
I love Disney too. Like, that's part of why I think, every person who loves Disney... right now is kind of heartbroken by their behavior, you know? This is what happens
they cultivated the natural resource of whimsy and love, and now they're fucking brutally extracting it for all the profit they can. I think I'm not going to say that, like, Disney didn't develop and produce a lot of stuff, like, for broader purposes. Like, I think it would be crazy to suggest that, like, what's a movie? Like, I think they probably designed Flounder in The Little Mermaid, knowing they were going to sell Flounder plushies.
Totally. Yeah.
But I think, I feel in my soul that all of their movies, like, came... The initial seed and the driving force behind it was like, this is a story that we are interested in telling.
Right.
And I think you see that also with, like, early Pixar stuff, like everything until Elemental. I don't know.
Yeah.
Everything up, you know, Inside Out was like the last one. And then, like, more recently, I think the stories have come from, like, well, we're kind of weak on, like, these two quadrants, so we need a story that's going to tell these things,
exactly.
And also gonna drive, you know, gonna produce a mascot that we can put in costume at our parks. And it's very like business focused storytelling.
Right. It's like they're reverse engineering from the business decisions they will have seen in the past at the point in the future they're projecting for themselves. You know
right.
what I mean?
And it's like a lumber company. No, that's not a good example. No, it is. It's fine. It's like a lumber company trying to, like, genetically modify the best tree instead of just, like, harvesting the trees that work. That's a horrible example. What's a good example?
I mean,
I think everybody gets
sure.
it.
I mean, I don't think it's a, like, my, you know, sort of favorite analogy for business decisions in the art industries right now has been, like, ecological, you know? And I
think it's Monsanto.
That it is. It's Monsanto. Exactly. Where it's like, you know, if we just, like, we have a pest problem, so we'll just kill everything that isn't the exact thing we want to be growing here, and that actually makes things a lot worse. You actually get more pests that way. You get more, less nutrition. You get, you know, like everything that everything that you like about the thing that you're trying to grow is worse because you tried to.
You ever wonder why corn sucks now? You ever have corn grown in a garden? Oh my!
Incredible!
Fucking
God. A tomato?
That shit is awesome!
Oh my God!
Oh. Of cucumber. Wow.
Let's name vegetables.
Do we have anything else to say about 101
What's your favorite part?
1961?
I have three.
My favorite, I loved so much of this movie that I forgot to write down. No, I didn't. My favorite part of this movie was the Twilight Bark. Mm-hmm. I liked it so much. All the little like things with the dogs jumping out the window and barking, and the
dog jokes,
Lady and the Tramp, the dog jokes, the Lady and the Tramp. I wanted to say resume. That's not the right word. Cameos. Then like the country dogs were so cute. That's when we meet the Colonel, who's like, as you said, a fucking all time great character that is deeply underrated in the Disney
and
mythos.
Sergeant Tibbs.
Sergeant Tibbs is so great.
The pair of them, the horse also, but like those two are—they're so funny.
They're so good together. Oh my God, I don't know what I'm writing next, but I'm gonna put like the retired colonel and his long-suffering manservant in it, because it's like, and
it's
I think
a great
like,
dynamic.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, it's like there's so many like excellent comedic duo archetypes that show up in this movie. Right, the Horace and Tibbs like vaudeville guy, the like, you know, the servant and commander in these two. I can't think of anything else. So there's two really great vaudeville, you know, classic performance vaudevillian clowny tropes, and they just, it's like there's a reason.
I'd say the cows are a little bit of a vaudeville trope themselves, you know.
The nice old ladies.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah.
What was your favorite part?
Well, my first favorite part is the scene where Pongo is objectifying all the dogs and their people.
Good.
It's so cute. Cute, and it's such a. I think it's like kind of a really elegant introduction into what kind of movie you're going to be watching. You know, and also just the kind of animation that you're in.
Yeah,
it's
so good. It's like that, like watching 101 Dalmatians made me wish that Disney kept experimenting with animation style, because like as much as I love classic Disney, it's like the studio right now that has my animation heart is Sony. Sony right now, as of 2025,
they're doing interesting things.
They're just trying shit, you know. Bad Guys, Teenage Mutant Ninja, no, that was DreamWorks. The Spider-Verse movies, which I have a huge problem with the second one, but it looks amazing.
What's your problem with the second Spider-Verse movie? I'm so curious.
It doesn't end. Like, there's no ending. The second Spider-Verse movie is half of the half of the story that they wanted. They told half a story.
Does that bother you because you felt that they didn't like warn you properly or what?
It bothers me because it's like, make a TV show, you fucking idiot. I mean, coward. Like, movies end at the end of the movie. This movie didn't end. This movie got to the halfway point and was like, come back in 3 years for the next one. No.
What if I'm dead? Okay.
Yeah.
That's fair, I guess. I disagree,
you know,
but all right.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, you're allowed to not like that either. You're allowed to be unhappy if you want.
It's like, at least Infinity War, like, it ended.
Did it?
It was an ending.
Kind of.
Yeah. Well, like, the...
It was a cliffhanger.
It was a cliffhanger, but there was a complete story.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, I completely agree. And, like, it seems like the thing that Disney is really sort of experimenting with in this one is, like, is movement. you know, which is part of why I like that first scene, because like it's making a point to have the dogs and their people move in exactly the same way, which I think is so cute. And it's and like each of the dogs and their humans are so stylized specifically and individually. I love it. Mm-hmm. It's adorable. Mm-hmm. The Twilight bark is my next favorite part. And I mean, like the Twilight bark sequence is also like 15 minutes long. It's like so a quarter long of the movie.
It's so long, and yet it's so well done.
It's amazing.
And this is a lot of these. Let me talk into the microphone. This is a lot of these older Disney movies. Is like these sequences are long as shit, but they're so good that I don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, wait, hold on. Why are you moving on?
Like, yeah, I want to see more dog hijinks. More lady
give me more lady as a puppy. Yeah. Give me more Twilight Park.
Yeah. And
give me more dog in person walking the same way.
I want to watch this movie again. It's so good. And then my last favorite part is when they all disguise themselves as Labradors. I think that's such an adorable conceit. They'll cover themselves in ash and pretend to be Labradors so that and like are just walking right past Horace and Jasper and Cruella.
I love that they were like could all of these puppies? Could all of these puppies be the Dalmatians?
Yeah.
No, obviously they're all.
The dogs aren't disguising themselves as But then also, like, it's, you know, we already talked about this a little bit. Like, it's, like, you know the puppies are all going to be fine in the end, but it's really hard to, like, they sustain tension really, really well. It's really hard to predict exactly how they're going to get out of this situation. Like, that entire sequence, part of why I like it, you know, apart from it just being really cute, is that it's, like, it's really tense. It's like, oh my God, are they going to make it? Are they going to get all the puppies in time? Or are they going to, like, be a few left behind?
I thought that a few were going to get left behind.
They'd have to find another way.
I liked it a lot.
It's so good.
Great movie.
It's such a
good
movie.
Go see 101 Dalmatians, 1961.
Please do. You deserve it.
It's really great. But now... Oh, no, wait. Now we're going to... Hold on. Before we move on to 101 Dalmatians, 1996, I want to give a little shout out to the people who let us...
Oh, is this where we're putting our Patreon?
This is where we're putting the patrons until we get sponsored.
Okay.
Thank you so much to all of our patrons. Everyone's getting thanked today because I don't remember if the $2 get thanked or not. big thank you to such patrons as A Long Way Home, Ryder, Seamus Bredig, The Wizard Sober, Mark Wampler, C-Tone, Well, an Inspector, Joshua Paul, Fading into Obscurity, The Antithesis.
Gus is putting his head in his hands right now.
The Antithesis, Wells Harrell, Forrest Cochran, Ted the Dead, Ryan Faber, Andrew Ray, Samoa, Gun Parade, Colleen Burns, Chimarathon, Charlotte DeWittler, Detweiler, James Trendle, Sky Killane, Christine H., Chloe, Dana Loy, Donnie, Aaron Summers, Thomas McFarland. You guys are great.
Damn, that's so many people.
I know. It's like 20.
That's so
people.
Cool. That's plenty. You. That's plenty of people. To
keep we don't need
going.
Any more. Nobody
no more,
else
no more
sign
patrons.
Up. Do not go to patreon.com/oncemorewithfeeling and give us money. Don't do it. We're good.
Let's talk about 101 Dalmatians, 1996.
Tell me about 101 Dalmatians, 1996.
Okay,
I'll
tell you
what. I was 2 years old when this movie came out.
I was 3. Are you younger than me?
Yeah.
That's weird.
How's it weird? Because I'm bald? I have to be older than you?
I don't know.
You dye your hair, probably.
I do dye my hair, yeah.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, I'm going gray because of all the stress. Yeah.
No grays on my head, except when
no
I'm
hairs on your head.
Having a really rough month.
So 101 Dalmatians 1996 is the same movie as the animated version. It's very, very similar, yeah, except the dogs don't talk. Anita is a fashion designer who works for Cruella, who is secretly stealing endangered animals to skin them. Very horrifying. She steals a white tiger and its skin arrives at her door. Yeah. Roger is instead, he's not a musician. He's instead a video game designer.
Bad choice. This is
the 90s. It's so stupid. It's really
not
dumb.
A good.
It really dates the movie, you know?
The Anita change was great.
Yeah.
The Roger change,
not great. Not great at all.
Nah.
So Roger and Anita get married, but this time Anita also has a baby instead of just Pongo and Perdita. I don't know why they did that. I don't think it adds very much. The baby is of no consequence whatsoever to the plot. Horace and Jasper, Cruella, puppies get stolen. Bulldog watches Jasper and Horace steal the puppies. He starts the Twilight bark. And then for most of the movie, it's just like the adventures of this Airedale Terrier, which I guess is like our sort of colonel. Jesus Christ, Rita. Did you hear that?
No.
She just did one of those, like, yeah, she did one of those, like, dog horks, you know? I'm going to keep that if it made it into the microphone.
Gross.
So this Airedale Terrier, I guess, is supposed to be our colonel stand-in. It's all very cute. He finds the puppies. He gets them out. Pongo and Perdita run away. They find the puppies. Cruella tracks them down to a farm where some raccoons push her into a vat of molasses, which is weird because there are no raccoons in England. And then,
are there not?
No.
What do they have?
Nothing.
They have no rodent-like scavenger animals?
Raccoons aren't like rodents at all. I mean, they have hedgehogs.
Oh, right. They're like bears.
Yeah.
I forgot.
They have hedgehogs. They have wildcats. They have like weasels and stuff like that. Like weasel-type guys.
Of course.
Yeah, ermines
of
and
course.
Stuff. Martins.
Well, maybe they're just weasels that like dressed up.
Sure. Jim Henson did all the animal puppets for this movie.
Did he really?
Yeah. There aren't that many, but what puppets there are were Jim Henson. Finally, the police show up. They arrest Cruella and Horace and Jasper and the taxidermist, their silent, scary taxidermist. And then they all get skunked by a skunk that made it into the car, which is also weird because there are no skunks in England either.
This was definitely written by an American.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
An American named John Hughes? What the fuck?
All the dogs go home. Roger sells this stupid video game, and then they all move to the Dalmatian plantation.
I totally forgot that there was more on the thing. So let me do that segue one more time. I feel like this movie was written by an American.
Which American do you think wrote this movie, Gus?
I think, oh my god, John Hughes of 16 Candles fame? Holy shit.
Convincing.
I wrote on my notes in the opening when it said, like, written by, I saw John Hughes, and I was like, motherfucking John Hughes? Question mark?
Uh-huh. Yeah, John Hughes wrote this movie. He wrote it, and it's kind of unclear. This is kind of unusually for a movie in 1996 that was as successful as this movie was. There's not a whole lot of production information on it, but it does seem like it was kind of his project, you know. And like John Hughes was super famous by then, most certainly. So certainly today, but also I think in 1996, you'll probably know better than me. Like, I don't think it's that common for like a screenwriter to have an oversized amount of influence on what happens with the movie. You know what I mean?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I know today it's not.
Yeah.
But it always depends on how much clout you have,
yeah,
and how much the company like wants to work with you again, mm-hmm, and how much of a shit you are. Because if you're a little bit of a shit most of the time and you try to put your foot down, it might be worth it. But mm-hmm, if you're a big shit and you do it too much, I think they'll just be like, it's not worth working with this guy
anymore. A medium-sized shit in the film industry. Well, is the last
be like, choose your battles, you know? Like, if you disagree with a note, try it. Maybe try it badly.
So what asked
I don't know. I think someone like John Hughes is big enough that he could probably have some good influence on it. Was he did he get credited as a producer at all? Okay, not so that maybe I saw. Maybe not. I don't know.
So he wrote it, but he didn't direct it. Instead, it was directed by Stephen Herrick, who also did Bill and Ted, Mighty Ducks, Mr. Holland's Opus, big 90s classics.
I like a couple of those movies a lot.
Yeah. John Hughes is the one who convinces Glenn Close to do the movie, though. 300 Dalmatian puppies they went through this movie. Puppies grow really fast. They had to have enough puppies to have them on set when they were really cute. And to, maintain consistency across the movie, get like, oh my God, the difference between an 8 week old puppy and a 12 week old puppy, like doesn't look like the same dog. Just get an adult dog, y'all. Don't bother with puppies.
You can even see like in the movie, the puppies in the last shot look much different than they do like when they first start running away from Hell Manor. Hell Mansion. What's it called? Hell House?
Yeah. Hellman. In Cruella's Hellman House. That's what's stuck in my head. But then she takes the man off. Yeah. Because.
Yeah. And if you want to know more about Cruella, join our 28 patrons and get your name read out in the middle of a podcast episode.
So many puppies for this movie. So producer Edward Feldman made a very big and very public deal about having secured adoptive homes for every single puppy during production. And we'll just have to take his word on that, I guess, because it's not like there's any documentation that I could find for where all these puppies went. But there was a lot of concern by animal welfare groups, and rightly so. There's a lot of dogs to have, so many animals just in general to deal with here. I can see that there would be a pretty clear and present concern that these puppies would just get dumped at the pound after filming, but apparently that didn't happen. So all the puppies stayed in a single house with 13 trainers, which sounds like such a great time. They should make a movie about that.
Literally my dream.
I know.
Oh my just god. That's
with 300 that's puppies.
Like, oh my god. That's like 40 puppies per trainer. Do you think like they had like makeup doing spots on the main puppies?
Maybe. I think they may have.
If they went through five, like obviously Dipstick's tail was
right
done.
Stupid name for a dog.
It's an awful name. They did not name the dogs well in this movie.
I wouldn't be surprised. I know that was like this pretty common practice before CG really gets off the ground. Like I know in Hidalgo, I think like the markings on the like hero horse in Hidalgo are really specific. It's like a very sort of like the paint pattern on that horse has like really complicated edges, and so for the horses they would use in other scenes, they would have to like go in with a paintbrush and like paint the fucking horses. I wouldn't be surprised if they did that here. In an LA Times report about the movie, when it was announced, Disney chair Joe Roth said, "I read the script over the weekend and it reminds me very much of Home Alone," which it does. It's very Home Alone, this movie. And I think this is what I was thinking about when I failed to articulate this thing that Disney is doing right now, maybe half an hour ago. I don't know. I think it's interesting and useful to see what movies come out a few years before certain movies, because big studios tend to green light projects based on pitches that compare the movie someone wants to make to a movie that's already
ten,
come out.
Tend to.
Always.
Tend to.
they the movie request Alien. Comps.
The only reason the movie Alien was greenlit by Fox Studios, I think it was Fox, was because Star Wars had come out in 1977 and Jaws had come out in 1974, and both of them blew the fucking roof off. And so the person who had written Alien, who had written it, I think, before either of those movies came out, definitely before Star Wars came out, was like, it's Jaws plus Star Wars. Yeah,
this is something that they, that like, if you go to film school and take any producing class, they will tell you to include in your pitch that like producers expect this is something to
that
hear
I,
this.
This is something that I have it, that I do include in my pitch. This is something I wrote. I wrote, there's a movie that I have producers on right now that I'm actually, I have a call with them later today to go over some potential notes for a minor rewrite. It's a coming-of-age movie about a lightly autistic person in college dealing with his mom's death, flirting, very sweet, very coming-of-age. You'd feel like you wouldn't have to comp that movie. Yeah. You would feel like, oh, it's coming-of-age? It's a dramedy? Okay, I get it. But you still have to comp it. We did like Edge of 17 plus Atypical or something like that. I don't.
Yeah. This is something that studios expect to hear. Tell me what this movie is like and tell me how this is going to fit into our business model. And I think I think that one of the things that's really fucking up Disney right now is that all these movies that they keep making, because they're, you know, they're, you know, drawing out of a well that's already empty. They're trying to grow a crop on depleted land. They're trying to, you know, whatever, fill in your ecological metaphor here. Like their movies, because they're
trying to patent all the corn seeds.
Yeah.
That's mine.
Because they're doing that, like, they have such a monopolistic presence in the industry that their movies are making money, but they're not making money for any reasons that are good. You know, so it's like, you can.
They're making money because it's like, the fuck else am I gonna watch?
Yeah, so you can makes perfect sense to comp something like Cruella to Maleficent because Maleficent made a bunch of money, but did it make money because it's good, or did it make money because of other reasons? But like in the 90s, that's a little different. It makes sense to comp a movie like this to Home Alone, which of course is also written by John Hughes.
It was.
And it is very Home Alone. And I think that's to its modest benefit, you know?
Yeah.
I think it works. It's a little silly, but it's supposed to be a little silly.
Did you find why they picked 101 Dalmatians?
No.
You couldn't find it?
No, dude. I couldn't find any justification for why this movie. It doesn't make any sense to me. It seems like a huge undertaking, you know?
Like, yeah, because there weren't a lot of... Like, what other Disney movies were coming out in 1996?
Here's what I think it might be. I think that complicated as this movie is, it's probably the least complicated that would have made sense for Disney to try and tackle. They had just done The Jungle Book as well. So I actually think that I think Jungle Book is our next episode, and I think we're gonna have to do, that's gonna be a three-parter also.
But this time everyone's getting the third part.
So that'll be fun. I'm excited for that. But like, it's too soon to remake all the Disney Renaissance movies. It just is, you know.
It's too soon. It was still happening.
Yes.
Yeah, so, fucking
yeah.
Hunchback of Notre Dame came out right, like,
it's kind of crazy that movie ever made four, the light of day.
4 months before 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah, that's wild. So it's too soon to do any of the Disney Renaissance movies again. But all of the older movies are just too fucking complicated. I think, like, Peter Pan is too complicated. Alice in Wonderland is going to be too complicated. The least complicated option is just the one where you have to have a bunch of animals on set, you know.
Do you think Snow White was too complicated?
I don't think Snow White was too complicated, but I do think it was maybe a little too difficult to sell, maybe. You know, because they're most certainly targeting children, like kids with this, with this movie and with the Jungle Book remake that also came out in the 90s.
If they're targeting kids, I must be a toddler. I liked it so much.
It's so much fun. It's like, it's dumb, you know. But it's well made. It's cute. It's sappy. Glenn Close is unbelievable. She's so funny.
It blew my fucking like. We talked in Maleficent, and especially when we were talking Maleficent, there's a little preview for the everybody. For like all of these movies that have like a character, like a character, they always do reveals. Like the reveal is a very important part of the movie when you reveal the character's face. And so far, live action wise, they kind of been fucking it up.
Yeah.
The Cruella reveal in this movie is perfect.
Remind me how it happens.
I don't remember it. I do not remember it. I just see that I wrote outstanding Cruella reveal.
I think she's.
And I trust my opinions of 2 days ago.
Is she in her office maybe, and she's like in a chair and swivels around? It's like it's something it's like that.
I remember her like I remember seeing like the stilettos coming out of the car.
Well, there are a few, and that's part of what I think is working well about how like just how they're framing and like how they're shooting this movie is that there are several Cruella reveals that like that she it's so camp, like, you know, her silhouette in the window, you know, like she they open the door and she turns around, like all that shit. There's reveal after reveal. She's
I remember it. And I remember it, I just pulled up the clip. We're outside her building. Okay. She runs a fashion company. Yeah. The car pulls up. The doorman opens the door, and we see like a partial shot of her. Let me describe it. So as she turns, we don't see her face. We see her cigarette holder. She taps out the cigarette. We see the like claw, the talons on her gloves.
Incredible touch.
She steps out with the stilettos. She walks. We see like the skunk fur coat up the steps. Still from her back, House of DeVille, that's what it's called. She walks through the office, but her hat is covering her face with the veil.
A fascinator, this just, is called.
Okay. Well, I thought fascinators were tiny. This is a
they
big,
don't have to be.
Like, Spanish Inquisition hat.
Okay, but there's still a veil?
Yeah.
This counts as a fascinator.
It's like a mourning veil.
Okay.
She goes up to Anita, and then Anita turns, and then that's like when we see her face, like a full like horror movie shot. It's so good. And Glenn Close, fucking unbelievable.
She kills
in this role.
It. It's big, you know?
I'll say like I liked this movie. I enjoyed watching it. It's worth watching this movie just for her.
It really is. It's so good. It's so much
fun. I wrote like with Glenn Close's performance in this movie, I completely understand why they would make Cruella.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
It didn't work. Like they didn't do it right. But I get why they would.
No, but and make there are it. Certain parts about Cruella that I think do work because they are in that line of you know, that kind of campiness, the same Disney villain rule that we laid down in Peter Pan, that like if this can be turned into a drag performance, you got yourself a good villain, you know.
We need the silhouette, we need the drag performance.
Yeah, you need to be serving. This movie cost $67 million before marketing. It's maybe like 120 million, 130 total, who knows. It makes $320 million. It is super successful. It comes out, I think, a Thanksgiving weekend, which is the perfect release date for a movie like this. And yes, I am.
Speaking of drag performances.
It made $46 million of those dollars in its first weekend. That's crazy.
That's a lot. So that's a great
dollars. And then it stays in theaters
and
for 5 months.
And this is 1996 dollars.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
super blockbuster movie. So much so that it causes a huge spike in Dalmatian adoptions, which is very controversial.
I have a quote from The Wonderful Girlfriend. It was right after we were introduced to the Crooks, mm-hmm. and we see the Dalmatians chilling in the home, and she goes, I want a Dalmatian.
You don't, though. They're like
dogs. I need low energy dogs. I want a cuddly boy, two walks a day. Yeah.
Oh, you'd like Russ a lot.
Potty train.
Dalmatians are not that. They're kind of, I don't know. They look like they'd be a chill dog. They're not at all. Like they look like they're like,
they're crazy high
energy. They're crazy high energy. They're not like a herding dog, but for some reason they've got like herding dog neurosis, you know, like they're fucking crazy dogs. And that's a problem because they look really cute in these movies and
they have the spots.
And so a bunch of people got Dalmatians and a bunch of Dalmatians got abandoned. It's very sad. I remember in the late 90s, early 2000s, like in the years following this movie, there was a local Dalmatian rescue that would hold adoption day, like events at the movie theater.
Local to where?
Oklahoma. Norman. Wow. And they would like, you know, it'd be like a little education event. And also you can adopt these and like meet a real Dalmatian and like, aren't they cute? And maybe you can take one home, but don't do it on a fucking whim, you idiot.
Something like 15 to 20% of Dalmatians are deaf in mm-hmm. at least 1 year.
Yeah. Yeah. That was another aspect of this that like, it's one of those dogs. I mean, like any dog that becomes super popular always gets super overbred, but that can be more dangerous for some dogs than others. And Dalmatians have Australian Shepherds are similar, where you'll get like people will not breed them correctly, and they'll like breed for color over function and do risky breedings and end up with a bunch of deaf dogs that end up being put down. It's
Listen, if you're an at-home breeder, breed for health.
Breed for health.
Over
your dogs
everything.
Will still be cute. I promise.
You ever see a crossbreed? You ever see a mutt? They're fucking
adorable.
They're
so cute.
They're so cute.
Sometimes they're cuter. So yeah, this movie was kind of critically middling, because it's a you know, family kids movie in the 90s. It's a John Hughes movie. Who cares? Roger Ebert said the problem with the new live action version of 101 Dalmatians, based on the 1961 feature length cartoon, is that it's never really able to make the dogs as important as the people. Which I pulled because I think it's true. I think that actually is a good piece of criticism. It's only that like I think it's kind of got Dark Knight problems where
the Joker is the main character.
Yes, Cruella is just so interesting and so fun to watch. Yeah. But I guess the difference is that like you're never rooting for Cruella, you know. Unlike the Joker, there's
Listen, you can kill a judge, you can assassinate the mayor, you can blow up a whole American city, but if you try to kill a couple dogs, there's full-on construction happening outside.
It's okay. We'll just have to deal. Listen, if you want, we said it in past episodes, we'll say it in future episodes. If you want proper audio, you're gonna have to pony up.
this is the class. This is a season one stuff that we look back fondly as we both record from our like soundproof office in our respective mansions in like 4 years
in our Dalmatian plantations.
I would have a Maltese. Paltese.
What is a Paltese?
It's like a plantation, but
for Maltese.
Maltese Paltese. It works.
What did I say about something like? I think this is something that makes, just another great villain aspect that the reason you can kind of root for the Joker and not for Cruella de Vil is because there's nothing countercultural about Cruella de Vil, you know? There's no
there's nothing cool about skin and
there's
pups.
Not. This becomes a huge problem when we talk about Cruella, which we will do in a few minutes. Yeah. But like, she's a... she's a rich, entitled, nasty bitch who, like, looks fabulous, but her entire life is devoted to looking fabulous at the cost of literally every single thing around her. That kind of entitlement and that kind of arrogance is, I think, kind of pretty important to making any like actual, like, kind of lawful evil villain, you know? Like, I am bad. I'm a bad person who does bad things. And bad people who do bad things, as we're seeing in today's political situation, like, they do it because it's because of self-aggrandizement, because of narcissism, you know? And often those people are not, like, mysterious or countercultural. The people who are bad, just, like, morally, do tend to find themselves in positions of wealth and power because achieving wealth and power kind of, like, can often require not giving a fuck about anybody else. And that's,
I think that's true. And then I also think there's an important element of, like, there's a lot of bad people who never get that, who you just don't hear
totally
about. Because, you know, how am I going to hear about, like, the sociopath who made, like, four people's life awful in Maine?
Oh, for sure. Well,
I live in California.
Well, this is also, an aspect of the specific villainy of Cruella de Vil as an individual. She's an heiress, you know? Like, canonically, she's inherited all this money.
What a bitch.
Yeah, so...
We love Cruella, but we also
Cruella. She's incredible. She's iconic. She's an amazing villain.
She's one of the best movie heels of all
time. Yeah, she really is. And I like that. Oh man, I really want to start talking about Cruella, and it's just not time because all of this has to do with Cruella.
Soon.
It would have been so easy, and if they did I don't think they'll ever remake 101 Dalmatians in earnest now, because Cruella is too nasty. I think that, you know, and we've talked about this in previous episodes, that Disney is so concerned with, like, Disney wants to coddle kids so bad, not because they care about kids so much, but just
modern Disney,
not because they care about kids so much, but just because they don't want to run afoul of the parents for any reason at all. Having a villain who skins poor little animals to, like, make a fashion statement is so, like, just diabolically evil. That I don't think it's ever gonna happen in a Disney movie.
Yeah,
in the 21st century, it is sad.
How Disney has fallen.
Because I think there's like villains are awesome. Villains serve a purpose. You know.
Yeah. When you make the villain too nice and too sympathetic,
yeah,
you kind of run into some moral.
You really? We're just talking about Cruella now.
Issues.
Is there? Let's see.
Let's finish up this live action 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah.
I thought it was, like, scored super well. There were a lot of really great moments. Like, there's a early on, the way that Roger and Anita meet is that Pongo and Perdita. Pongo sees Perdita, loses his fucking doggy mind, and takes off after her while, like, leashed to Roger's bike.
Yeah.
And so he drags Roger through the city, classic 90s family comedy moment. And then Roger ends up flying into the pond in, like, Hyde Park or somewhere in London. And then a little bit later, Perdita takes off after Pongo while leashed to Anita's bike, and Anita ends up falling into the pond, the same pond, after, like, a brief interaction. And during that scene, there's a very, like, upbeat, like, Sousa version of Bicycle Built for Two, which I just liked so much.
I didn't notice that. That's cute.
Oh, my
God. There were little, like this... Cruella de Vil flourishes throughout, you know?
Oh my God. Just her little, like, Cruella
The spirit of Cruella in this movie was taken not by, this is a sneak preview, not by Emma Stone. It was taken by Emma Thompson.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
In Cruella.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk about that in a bit. I kept being shocked by like all these people in the movie. Like fucking Glenn Close, mm-hmm. Jeff Bridges, Hugh Laurie.
Not Jeff Bridges.
Jeff,
Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
Newsroom.
Jeff.
Jeff. You know him. He's Jeff.
Jeff.
Yeah, Hugh Laurie. This is a great Hugh Laurie role.
He's so funny. I think it was like right when he was doing like a bit of Fry and Laurie. Mm-hmm. And he fucking killed it. The guy who plays Arthur Weasley.
Oh, yeah. That's where he's from. Yeah, you're so right.
That wasn't me who... Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels. Yes, thank you.
That wasn't me who noted that. That was my wonderful girlfriend. The dogs were so cute. I legitimately started crying. Yeah. And then, like, there are some very silly, you know, Home Alone-y 90s moments in this movie, but it's such a cute movie that I forgive those moments very easily.
There's a...
because I was... Yeah.
There's a couple... kind of awkward CG shots that worked really well at the time that no longer really do.
No, they don't.
But, you know, overall, they stick to just, like, committing to just shooting, just framing the dogs properly and getting them to do cute things, you know?
I noticed what felt like a couple, like, composition shots when they wanted to get all the dogs in frame. I was, like, pretty, you know, sometimes they did... like you said, CG, which didn't look that great, but, you know, you can ignore it. And then, like, all the animal actors are so good.
I know.
Like, the raccoons are so good. Like, the dogs are good. The puppies are good. None of them ever look at the camera somehow. Maybe that's just great editing. The geese are good. Was there a goose? The horse is good.
The pigs are good.
The sheep are good.
All the animals are good.
The pigs are good.
The mouse is good.
The mouse is great.
The little Airedale terriers, all the animals are really good, and like it's a sort of
Colonel. The Colonel was good.
And like we've talked about this obviously with Dumbo and with Lady and the Tramp and whatever, and it was you know one of the things that like pleasantly surprised me. You apparently less so, but it's okay, you can be wrong sometimes, it's fine, it adds spice to the podcast.
Say that again.
Gus, pay attention.
I'm sorry.
I liked Lady and the Tramp more than you did is all that I'm saying.
The new one.
But
yes you did.
But one of the things that really pleasantly surprised me about it was that the dogs were mostly real. And that it kind of feels like a throwback now. Nobody wants to have real animals in their movies anymore. And I feel like
it's fucking horseshit.
It is horseshit. And I feel like it's...
And we'll talk about that in Cruella.
I feel like it's a very sort of late 20th century filmmaking skill that we're kind of losing now, having animals on your set and knowing how to frame them well and train them properly and get them to do what you want them to do without fucking abusing them, you know? I think this movie does that well. I like it. It's cute.
Extremely well. Do you think people should watch this movie?
I think you should watch this movie.
I had a great time.
Glenn Close is just, it's just such a good performance.
Phenomenal.
And it's so phenomenal. It's so of its time, but in a really fun way. It's you know, it feels vintage in a way that is nice.
this is interesting because this is at least my first like actual recommendation. Like I think it's worth it if you like Home Alone.
If
you like these 90s movies. To like go and seek out and watch this movie.
I don't think I would even make that recommendation for something like Cinderella, even though I like Cinderella. I would make it for
Fine.
Lady and the Tramp, though. I think that's a pretty good movie.
So definitely 100% watch the original one.
Oh yeah.
Probably
do yourself a favor.
Probably watch the 1996 live action.
But if
don't watch either sequel.
But if you've got 2 hours to live. You need to pick one. Pick pick the original. Yeah.
Yeah, and then watch.
It's an all-time watch great.
Watch again the first like 50 minutes of it with that leftover time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anything else?
I guess not.
Okay.
I guess that's it.
How do we end this?
Man, I don't know. I
ask this every fucking
time.
Well,
I feel like it's different when you know we have another movie to talk about.
No, because we end the podcast and then the other movie is the bonus.
We've only done it once. Yeah. Is that what we do?
We just stop recording. No, we keep recording. I just say, Mark, not this time. And then, whatever. They don't need to know all this. thanks so much for listening to episode 8 of Once More With Feeling, podcast about great original movies, and they're often not so great remakes. Did I fucking delete... No, it's in a different document.
Oh my god.
Jesus Christ. So sorry. We'll have another one for you in 2 weeks. I think what's that one? Jungle Book?
Yeah.
Woohoo. Ooh, Jungle Book. It's gonna be and that's so a three-parter cuz we're looking at the original 1967 and then this era 1994 and then the modern era 2016. That's
I'm
gonna be
so
very
excited. It's gonna be a
discussion.
Super interesting episode.
You're gonna want to listen to that one. If you want to support us as those lovely 28 people do in the middle, check out our Patreon, which is linked in the show notes. Become a member of our movie club. Come join us on Discord, which is active, and we have good conversations. I'm very happy.
Yeah,
about that.
Yeah. It's working so far.
Follow us on social media, various social medias, mostly Instagram right now, at With Feeling Pod. Have any questions, comments, concerns? Did you hate this movie and are a bad person? Would you like to call me dumb on Patreon or directly to my face? Please email us at withfeelingpod@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Too often stripped of love, just stare.